Welcome to How to Money. I'm Joel.
And I am Matt.
And today we are answering your listener questions.
Oh yeah, that's right, man. We've got listener questions lined up today. We are answering some questions about Fundrise. Everyone's heard of Fundrise, right?
Yeah.
Well, if you haven't, you're going to hear about it today.
You'll know what it is, but most people know what it is.
That's true. Funky life insurance, we got some of that lined up, as well as some sustainable investing options for folks, plus a couple other questions that we always leave to our listeners' imagination. It's kind of like a mystery grab bag, like mystery flavors, you know? Like you always get something and it's just like, what's behind that question mark? I don't know.
Like the old school Airheads, the white one, the ones in the white package?
That's right. Oh, I totally forgot about that, man. I hadn't thought about Airheads in forever.
Let's not think about them.
did you not like Airheads back in the day?
They were okay, but you know, not my favorite candy.
One of my
sure.
favorite candies that I used to get at the my neighborhood pool as a kid. We'd go there in the summer, and you could get those giant sweet tarts. You know what I'm talking about?
Like
the giant ones that were chewy.
Uh-huh.
I feel like we've talked about these on the show before. I don't know, but I used to love those things. Chew.
Let's go find some.
Something about the chew for me is what did it, man. They were so good.
But before we get to that, the candy, we got an episode to make here. So
that's true.
And before we get to the listener questions real quick, Matt, just wanted to say, one, we love when listeners engage with the show. There's so many ways to do that. The Facebook group is one. Submitting your listener question for a future Ask HTM episode is another. And then a third way, Matt, in which you can engage with the show is if you teach a personal finance class in high school, you can share this podcast with your students. And actually, a teacher named Greg recently reached out to us via email.
Yeah.
He teaches a personal finance class at North Central High School. And so we just want to give a shout out to him and to all the kids at North Central
all
the students.
Yeah, they're not kids. These are like high school seniors, man. They're adults.
Yeah, you're right. They are, especially if they're
seniors. Fight for us in the wars.
Well, I just wanted to say thanks to Greg for sharing our content with those students and to the students themselves for listening, paying attention. And Greg shared with us some of the forms that he makes his kids fill out after listening.
Worksheets.
They're called worksheets. Okay. Here's the question. It's like, well, did you actually learn anything when you listened? And so it makes them think critically about the information. But it's cool that y'all listen to the show. And I don't know that our show is necessarily worthy of higher education institutions, but the fact that it's being used in that way definitely is humbling and pretty cool.
I love it, man. Yeah, it made me think too. You kept saying Greg, but I guess they all call him like Mr. I think it's Wadalich or Wadalich.
Okay,
but he's also maybe a coach, so maybe they call him Coach Wadalich.
Maybe they do. Coach W.
Coach Dub.
Yeah,
Mr. Dub. Anyway, I mean, I think this is amazing too because I did not have personal finance formally taught to me, at least in high school, right? I mean, these are lessons I learned from my parents as a kid growing up, but to have this formally taught in school is amazing. I just imagine how all these students are going to be, they're going to have a leg up when it comes to them getting out there into the real world, whether it's their first job or, you know, getting out there to college. But I love that Mr. W, that he is doing this, and hopefully too that it maybe encourages other educators out there to make sure that this is something that is being taught in high schools.
Yeah, and I want to say to anybody else out there who maybe teaches a personal finance class, man, you're welcome to use our material. Not that it's necessarily the best out there, but anything that's going to help connect students to learning the important things they need to know about personal finance, man, we're all about that. We support that 100%. And Matt, it actually reminds me of episode 98. We talked with Dan LaSalle, and he was a teacher up in Philadelphia, became the vice principal of that school, I think. And then he was making some massive strides when it came to personal finance education in his school. We'll put a link to that episode in the show notes, but I just loved, one, his passion, and then two, the real world ways in which he was introducing the students at his school to how personal finances work. I mean, he was putting money in their hands to do work to help them learn about investing and saving, and that was just really inspirational.
Yeah, most definitely. Yeah, so listen back to that episode if you have not heard that one and this is something you're interested in. And again, thanks to Mr. W up there at North Central High School. We appreciate you reaching out.
All right, Matt, let's mention the beer that we're having on the show today. It's called Cash Flow by Two Tides Brewing. Of course, a beer called Cash Flow. We got to try that.
You saw that on the shelf and you're like, all right, well, definitely going to have that on the show.
Yeah, exactly. So we'll talk about our thoughts on this beer at the end of the episode. But of course, we're taking listener questions on this episode. You can submit yours. There's simple instructions on how to do that at howtomoney.com/ask. Matt, let's get to the first one. This one's not about short-term saving goals or retirement saving goals, but where do you put money in the medium term?
Hi, Matt and Joel. This is Mackenzie from New York City. This is actually my second question that I've submitted, and you helped me out with the first one at the beginning of the pandemic, so I'm really grateful to you, and I'm hoping I can get your advice on the second question, which is thinking about medium-term savings goals. So if I'm thinking of buying a house in 10 years, should I be investing the money that I'm saving towards that goal? And if so, what do you recommend for where I should be putting that money? Thank you so much. I hope that you are well, and I'm looking forward to hearing your answer. Thank you so much. Bye.
Hey, Mackenzie, thanks for sending in another question. We are doing well, and yeah, we hope that you are continuing to do well up there in New York City, and hopefully we'll also be able to provide you with some help with this second question, just like we did last time.
Yeah, try not to screw it up.
So let's talk about medium savings goals, because they can be tricky, you know? So much of what you decide to do with your money, it comes down to a specific time frame. So if you need that money in the next year or two, we would consider this more of a short-term goal, then in this case, a high interest savings account is always going to be the best place to put that money. Even with rates as low as they are now, you're not necessarily looking to grow that money, but you just want to make sure that you're keeping that money safe and earning some interest on it. And the reason that you would want to save this money instead of investing it is because there's a lot of risk in a shorter time period in the stock market. But of course, there's no risk by putting that money in a savings account. And so, you know, the more distance, though, that you have before you want to use that money, then the more investing becomes a smart move, in large part because a greater time horizon is going to diminish the level of risk that you're going to experience.
Yeah, so when you have a diminished level of risk, when you have a time frame, we're talking about a decade in order to grow this money, Mackenzie, you're actually looking to grow this money instead of just saving it and making sure you don't lose any of that capital. So because your home purchase date is that far off, we would definitely encourage you to invest the money that you're accruing for that home purchase. Don't just save it. When you look historically, there have been very few 10-year periods in the market where the S&P 500 has had a negative return. So you can still feel comfortable, I think, investing in a mostly stock portfolio when you have a timeline that's this long. Because your risk level is minuscule, you can be confident, I think, in your ability to get better returns over the piddly savings rates that your bank is offering now. Again, at the most, what, 0.5%?
Yeah.
So when you have that long of a time horizon, I think it's okay to do mostly equity investing.
Yeah, totally. Any savings goals that we have, that's, you know, that's 10 years in the future or beyond, we're totally investing our money in stocks. And Mackenzie, you know, as far as which vehicle to put the money in, you can even, you know, invest within a Roth IRA. In fact, you know, we think that that might be one of the best places for you to put that money because you can take out any of your contributions that you make whenever you want, and then you can leave the earnings in there to continue to grow towards your retirement. So you can always withdraw contributions, right? But if you are buying your first home, you can actually avoid paying a penalty on up to $10,000 in earnings as well if you were to take some of that money out of your Roth IRA for that first home.
Yeah, so the Roth IRA just continues to be an excellent, flexible vehicle for people.
And we love it.
Yeah, and it's just like, I think probably the perfect place for Mackenzie to be stashing quite a bit of this money that she's saving up for a home. And ideally too, Mackenzie, this isn't going to be your only retirement account, because we'd hate to see you completely wipe out all of your retirement savings just for a down payment on a house, even though that is a big purchase. Hopefully, at the same time, you've got an employer match that you're able to fully participate in, so that you're simultaneously saving for retirement and saving for this goal of buying a home, and doing both of those essentially in tax-advantaged accounts. I mean, that's a great place to be.
Yeah, and Mackenzie, also, we want to applaud you for thinking so far into the future, right? Like, I mean, you're talking about buying a home in a decade, in 10 years. Very few people are making plans for themselves 10 years from now. You know, like oftentimes when it comes to a home, folks are like, oh my gosh, I want a house. And so let's find a way to buy a house in the next year or 2 years.
Maybe next year, but maybe next week.
Yeah.
But wait, I've only got 2% to put down. What do I do?
We're going to make it happen no matter what, right?
But the fact that Mackenzie is planning so far in advance is like admirable, and is something that we should all attempt to do more frequently, right?
Exactly. And obviously that's going to put her in a better position. She's going to be able to put down 20%. That means she's going to avoid paying private mortgage insurance, PMI, which is money that you are just completely losing. And so, yeah, Mackenzie, it sounds like you're doing an awesome job with your finances. We love it. And keep us posted. maybe in 10 years or maybe even less because you've been able to save your money more quickly. You'll have gotten a home and yeah, let us know how that goes.
No doubt. All right.
We'll still be here.
Yes, we will. All right, Matt, let's get to some more questions, including one about funky life insurance. We'll get to that question and more right after this.
Back from the break, and we've said funky life insurance now three times if you count just now, and so I'm going to call it silly life insurance, but we'll get to that that question here in a second. But first, let's talk about some sustainable investing options. Let's talk about ESG investing.
Hi Matt. Hi Joel. This is Tark from New Jersey. First things first, thank you. Your show is fun to listen to, and the freedom I've attained through a better understanding of personal finance has truly changed my life. Now, quick question for you. I invest in ESG index funds through my brokerage. They have slightly higher expense ratios than the comparable non-ESG index funds, which I also invest in. For example, last time I checked, the Fidelity's 500 index fund has an expense ratio of less than 0.05%, while the comparable ESG index fund was sitting around 0.11% expense ratio, which is over double. What is your take on ESG index funds as a means of long-term wealth building? Are the higher expense ratios reasonable to a limit? I know expense ratios can make a big difference in the long term, and I want to understand what I'm getting myself into. At the same time, the values behind ESG, especially sustainability, is important to me, and I like to put my money where my mouth is. Thanks again.
Tarek, first off, man, thanks so much for saying that. We really do appreciate you listening. And Matt, it's so true. It's amazing how learning to handle our money better is just such a game changer in what our lives look like. Like, money is an amplifier, I think, at times of what our lives look like. You and I, we're not all about amassing like ridiculous sums of money in order to, you know, be Scrooge McDucks and diving in it. But just handling it better removes a lot of a burden from your life that otherwise exists for so many people. So, and it sounds like that's been the case for Tarek. And so, yeah, Tarek, congratulations, man. Keep up the good work. Now, Matt, let's talk about socially responsible investing, how to invest in a sustainable way, and whether or not it makes sense for Tarek.
Let's do it, man. And first, you know, Tarek, he mentioned ESG investing. And so for those who don't know, that stands for environmental, social, and governance. These are funds that take into account not just maximizing their profits, but they're also looking at how different companies behave, right? Like how these corporations operate, and they don't just look at their bottom line. And so, first of all, ESG funds, they are becoming more and more mainstream, and we think that's pretty great. And that also means that the costs associated with these funds are going down, and in the coming years, man, I bet we'll see the expense ratios on ESG funds that are tied to a bigger index start to dip in a substantial way. And so if you were talking about a half or even a quarter of a point difference, that would make me balk. But the expense ratios, Tarek, that you mentioned are still incredibly low, so I wouldn't, you know, let that be the barrier to, you know, to your desire to invest in a sustainable way. You know, if you actually do the math, we're talking about a 0.06 difference in the expense ratios of the two funds that you mentioned. And so actually calculating that, if you were to max out your Roth over the next 30 years, that's only a difference of $6,000. And so I'm not going to say that $6,000 isn't nothing.
Yeah.
However, over the course of 30 years to know that you're able to invest in a way that aligns more with your values. And when you're looking at hundreds of thousands of dollars at that point, it's a small price to pay.
Yeah, Matt. And I think, interestingly enough, I don't think that expense ratio, that small increase in it, is going to lead to Tarek having less money. At least it hasn't, based on recent performance of ESG
exactly.
funds, right?
Yeah.
So, I think it's awesome that Tarek wants to put his money where his mouth is. Really, it's something that all investors should at least be thinking about, right? We want to invest not just to build wealth for our own futures, but also to build up companies that are making a positive impact, that are doing good. And Morningstar, Matt, found that ESG funds have been outperforming their basic index rivals in recent years. And they actually found that there's less volatility in a lot of these funds. Like in the recent downturn that we experienced last spring, those funds were more resilient. They didn't go down as much as the entire market as a whole, right? But although those are interesting data points, that doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be the case moving forward.
True.
But it is interesting to note that these ESG funds have been doing better. And so, yeah, when you're talking about a minuscule expense ratio difference, but with the added potential for a better performance, I agree with you. I think it is almost negligible, and it's not worth worrying about.
Yeah, it's really interesting how with these ESG funds, as they've become more popular, as more people have been looking to those metrics, you know, whatever it is that they are, that the ESG funds are performing better. It's almost as if by treating people better and by taking the environment into account and by running your corporation in a responsible way, it's as if these companies are being rewarded for it, which is, I mean, only a good thing, right? And so, Tarek, Joel and I, we feel that ESG investing, it is kind of more of a personal choice, right? You know, it's important to have done your homework on fees, allocation, things like that, before you make your decision on whether you'd prefer investing in ESG funds over their index fund counterparts. But as long as you are continuing to invest consistently and in a diversified manner, and, you know, when we do think that these index style ESG funds like ESGV, as well as FITLX, they definitely fit that bill.
And those are Vanguard and Fidelity's ESG funds. We'll put a link to those in the show notes. But
totally.
But basically, those are the two of the lowest cost ESG funds out there that you'd want to consider.
Exactly. And they're incredibly diversified as well. And so as long as you are able to maintain that wide exposure to the market, then in that case, we would say to follow your heart. Don't let those tiny fee differences stop you, because in the end, you may not actually see less money by investing in these ESG accounts. I mean, who knows? We can't tell the future, but there's a chance that you'll actually see your investments grow more.
Yeah, and Matt, the final thing we should say about socially responsible investing, we've talked about it on the show before. There are still some issues with it, some kinks being worked out about what companies are included, which companies are excluded. For instance, a company like Facebook is often included in these
funds.
Yet there are still some questions about how they use the data of their customers.
Sure, they're not pumping oil into rivers,
right.
But let's talk about privacy concerns.
Yes,
you know?
Exactly. Exactly. And so I think, you know, that is going to be interesting to watch how these funds adapt to other concerns that investors have that human beings have. And I think we'll get more clarity around standards in the coming years as these funds continue to mature. But Tarek, best of luck, man. Keep investing. And yeah, if you want to do it in a socially responsible way in one of those funds, we're all about it. All right, let's get to the next question, Matt. This one's about crazy, funky, silly life insurance.
A few agents are promoting long-term care products with IUL life insurance. They mentioned it is a tax-saving vehicle. My husband and I already have life term policy, so we are not sure if we should cancel the term and replace with IUL with long-term care rider. We don't think standalone LTC is a good option. Thank you for your advice, Amber.
Hey, Amber, great to hear from you, and we are glad to hear that you both have term life policies in place. For most people, having a basic level term policy is going to be more than sufficient, right? Term life insurance is ideal for a couple of reasons. Gives you coverage for a specific defined period of time when you most need it. And term life insurance, it is inexpensive.
I love inexpensive. It rocks.
Effective and cheap. Right?
Like, yeah, exactly.
That's what term life insurance is.
All right, well, let's talk about the other kind of life insurance, the funky variety.
IUL.
Yeah, that Amber's asking about. IUL stands for Indexed Universal Life. And it's going to cost Amber a whole lot more than that term policy, Matt, which you just mentioned, which Amber already has in place. And that's in part because the policy covers you not just for a specific period of time of 15 or 20 or 30 years, right? A specific term, but it's covering you for your whole life. That, of course, is going to be a more expensive product. Also, too, an IUL policy includes an investing component, too. So if you ditch your term policy, Amber, and you go with an IUL policy, your premiums are going to be a heck of a lot more expensive.
Way more.
In particular, because of those two factors that just drive up the cost in a big way. But then, Matt, there are other factors that drive up the cost too, right?
Yeah, obviously we're not fans of IULs because they're complex products that can also be kind of difficult to understand. You know, not surprisingly, you didn't go out in search for an IUL plan, but an insurance salesperson came knocking on your door to discuss it with you. The opaque generalities that they use to sell these products are—they're all a part of the plan, and that's because these policies make those salespeople a lot more money than just selling a term policy. The fees are honestly outrageous in most cases compared to, you know, what you're spending on term life. These sales folks, I mean, they have a vested interest in selling you on the incredible upside that an IUL will provide because, you know, they stand to benefit if you buy that policy.
It makes me think of the way timeshares are sold.
Yeah.
And I think you've gone to a timeshare presentation, right?
Yeah, for the free breakfast, man.
But, I mean, wasn't there a lot of pressure? Wasn't there a lot of salesmanship? Wasn't there a lot of touting the incredible, amazing, wonderful benefits?
They definitely were talking it up, but then, I mean, she kind of stopped when she realized that we were in college because it was two couples. It was me and Kate and, you know, plus another friend. friend, but we were in college at the time on spring break. And so we just explained to them that we ain't got that kind of money. Sorry.
Sorry. Well, I think, the same is true oftentimes with these IUL policies or similar funky life insurance products. The way they're talked about makes you think they're the greatest thing since sliced bread. But in reality, there's a lot of hidden fees. And so it's going to cost Amber a whole lot more money and not actually give her something that's better for her. Instead, Amber, of ditching your term life policy and going with something more expensive with the unnecessary bells and whistles that an IUL policy adds, we would say take the spread of what you would have spent by switching policies and sock that money away into a tax advantage retirement account instead. That's the best tax savings vehicle for you, not having investments inside of your life insurance policy. And if you feel the need to get more life insurance in the future, you can always ladder and get another term policy in order to add on to the amount of overall coverage that you have. But you don't want Index Universal Life. Almost nobody does. It's not a good product for almost anybody out there for a number of reasons. A term policy works perfectly fine in the case of like 99% of individuals, I would say. So don't call this person back and just kind of keep rolling with the term policy that is plenty good enough.
All right. Well, Amber, we hope that gets you pointed in the right direction. Always fun to answer an insurance question, Joel.
Oh, yeah. Insurance is the most fun topic out there, Matt, as we all know.
Well, I mean, let's be honest. Insurance, not sexy, but very necessary.
Yes, that's
right?
True. Yep.
Like, that's what we can agree on. All right. We've got a couple more questions, though, that we're going to get to right after the break, including one about real estate investing as well as Roth IRAs. Yet again, we have, but this time we're going to talk about it from a different angle. We'll get to both of those questions right after the break.
All right, back from the break, Matt, on a slightly sexier topic. We're talking about real estate investing now, which is, you know, I don't know, it is a little more interesting than life insurance, although that was kind of interesting, the funky angle to Amber's question. But Matt, let's get to this next one. This is about investing in real estate when you're too busy to actually buy a physical house near where you live.
Hey, Matt and Joel. This is Cheyenne from Memphis, Tennessee. I currently have a lot of exposure to the stock market through my 401k and Roth IRA, and I'm looking to get more into real estate, as I've heard you guys talk about on the podcast. My issue is that my day job is very time consuming, and I'm not going to have time to be the landlord myself, find a renter, buy houses, and everything that comes with it. And so my question is about these sites like Fundrise, if you think they would be a good idea for somebody in my situation. Thanks and love the show.
All right, let's get into it. Cheyenne, first, we love your desire to diversify beyond just stock investing for your retirement. Most people only think to invest inside of tax advantage accounts for retirement, but investing in other ways, like with real estate, can provide not only a healthy level of diversity for your portfolio, but also to add some current streams of income as well, which is very nice.
Yeah, I like that about real estate. I like the fact that not only is my investment increasing in value, but I'm also generating dividends essentially every month with the rent. But that is when you own physical real estate local to where you are. Let's talk about Fundrise in particular, Cheyenne. And Matt and I, we actually do get quite a few questions on Fundrise, although it's been a minute since we've discussed it on the show. And I think it is time to tackle it again, Matt. First off, we have nothing against Fundrise as a company. I think as far as crowdsourced real estate investing goes, Fundrise is actually at the top of the heap. They're one of the better players in that game, partly because they are not charging exorbitant fees like a lot of their counterparts. And they're not hiding their fee structure altogether like some of the other players in the crowdsourced real estate game. It can be hard to know what you're getting into. And when it comes to Fundrise, that's not the case. So from that standpoint, I would say Fundrise is a reasonable consideration. It is one of the better websites that you could go to in order to invest in real estate if you wanted to do it through the crowdsourced way.
That's true. But E-REITs like Fundrise aren't our favorite option if you want to get into real estate investing. Obviously, our number one avenue, our favorite way is buying a specific property where you live. But this is also assuming, too, that you've done the research, Cheyenne, and you know that you can get a healthier return from that property than you could otherwise, than you could in the stock market. Local real estate isn't inherently better, and actually it could be worse, potentially. When you buy a local property, it obviously comes with a massive upfront cost, and plus managing a property can be like a part-time job.
I can vouch for that.
Yeah, same here. But another downside to owning a single property or two is also the lack of diversification. You know, it's literally one house in one town, and since real estate is local, your returns in appreciation could be affected by small changes that you have zero control over.
Yeah, and what Cheyenne said too was, I'm busy. I don't want that part-time job. Yeah. I don't want to jump into real estate in that way. So that's why Fundrise is appealing, and I totally understand that. Yeah. I see the appeal. But let's talk about an alternative to both of those things. And so another route you can go in is adding more real estate exposure into your investment portfolio with publicly traded REITs instead of going with crowdfunded REIT sources online. These publicly traded REITs actually allow you to invest in specific real estate sectors, Cheyenne, like wireless towers, industrial space, medical offices, hotels, warehouses, and more, while paying less in fees and giving you more liquidity. I think both of those things are really important in this consideration. For instance, with Fundrise, you have to commit your money for 5 years in order to avoid fees for withdrawing that money early. But when we're talking about publicly traded REITs, your money isn't locked up like that. And the average fees of publicly traded REITs are actually 2 times less than what Fundrise charges. So you can imagine how bad the fees actually get when we're talking about the shadier crowdsourced REIT sites. But yeah, those are the reasons that we would suggest publicly traded REITs as opposed to the private crowdfunded REITs that are available to you online.
Exactly. And so, yeah, publicly traded REITs means you can purchase them just like you would an ETF or a mutual fund. And so some REITs to consider are iShares, Cohen & Steers REIT ETF, Spider, they have a good one as well, and VNQ from Vanguard. None of those have expense ratios over a third of a percent. And two of them are actually below 0.15, which is pretty dang good. And so, Cheyenne, you know, again, we love your desire to diversify here. And while Fundrise is solid, publicly traded REITs are more of a known entity here and can provide even greater diversification with lower fees. However, all that being said, it's worth mentioning that Joel and I, you and I, we don't invest in REITs at all.
Sure.
Obviously, we're invested locally in physical real estate properties here. And so we don't have a need or a desire to invest in REITs. But even if you did want to, and you weren't going to take the DIY approach and being a kind of a mom and pop landlord, we would recommend that you don't invest more than 5 to 10% of your portfolio in REITs. You want to make sure that you that you're still mostly invested in the overall stock market or the S&P 500.
Yeah, it's okay to have some exposure. You don't want too much exposure,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
And so, yeah, I think real estate is a good asset class to own in some way, form, or fashion. You want to make sure you're owning it in the right ways, though, and that you're not owning too much of it. You definitely want to stay diversified. But Cheyenne, best of luck in that, man. Hopefully that answered your question and set you off on the right course to actually start being a real estate investor. All right, Matt, let's take this next question. This one's about investing in a Roth. And is it allowed in this case?
Hi, Matt and Joel. This is Leslie calling from Leavenworth, Kansas. I opened a Roth IRA a couple of years ago because of the show, but I might have made a mistake with it in 2020. My husband is the primary breadwinner and I work very part-time. At the beginning of 2020, I fully funded my Roth IRA with $6,000 from our robust savings. And then throughout the course of the year, I realized I will have made less than $6,000. Is it okay to put more money in my Roth IRA than I actually earned this year? And if it's not okay, what do I need to do to fix it? If it is okay, because my husband earned that amount and obviously plenty more, is it okay if I also begin investing in my company's new 401k plan so that we are taking as much advantage of our tax advantage retirement accounts as we can? Thanks so much. Bye.
All right, Leslie, we got a little two-part question here from you, and let's go ahead and start from the top, right? It's great that you lump sum invested at the beginning of last year. You've likely already seen your money grow nicely since then, but let's go ahead and explain why you don't need to worry about your Roth. Normally, it's not okay to put more money in your Roth than you earned, right? In order to invest in a Roth, you have to have earned income, and the ceiling of what you're able to contribute is set by what you earned. But in your case, it's okay because if your tax status is married, filing jointly, you are allowed to contribute to a spousal Roth. And this isn't like a special type of Roth account, right? You can't like log into Vanguard, Fidelity, M1, and don't go looking for the spousal Roth option.
I don't want the regular Roth IRA. I want the spousal version.
No. It's not a separate account, but it's a benefit that you receive from being married.
Yeah. And you don't have to earn literally a single cent in a year,
right,
for the stay-at-home partner who's not earning any income to be able to contribute. You can contribute to two Roth accounts for both individuals, even if only one individual made all the money. And the fact that these spousal Roths exist is great. And couples who are able should prioritize contributing to both, including you and your husband, Leslie. And that means that both of you can put $6,000 a year aside in a Roth, which is great. And for folks that are over 50, you can put an additional $1,000 in every year for a total limit of $7,000. And that means, Matt, that depending on age, some couples could sock away a combined $14,000 in Roth IRA investments every single year, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, I love that, man. Yeah, a little personal anecdote here. Kate hasn't had an earned income in over 5 years, but we've had a Roth IRA that we've contributed to for the past 5 years. We've had no issues.
And she's rich now.
Yeah, Forbes is about to do a write-up on her next week.
All right.
Well, Leslie, yes to your last question as well. You know, you were asking about your 401k and your Roth. You know, invest in your Roth IRA and in your employer's 401k if you can afford to. If you don't need your income to pay the bills, then taking a sort of all of the above approach is going to help you to build wealth more quickly, and it allows you to take advantage of all the investing tax advantages that are available to you.
No doubt. I love it. So Leslie, guilt-free, invest in that Roth as much as you can. And I love that you and your husband are prioritizing investing for the future to that great of an extent. Good job. Good job to both of you.
I also like the idea of her going into her HR and saying, hey, can you increase the amount of my salary that's going towards my 401k? Can you maybe take that from 50 to 60%? They're gonna be like, wait, what?
Who are you?
Seriously, like they're going to look at you sideways. But seriously, I mean, if that's the position that you're in, if most of your bills are being covered by your husband's income and you can completely sock away every dollar that you're making, that's only going to set you guys up to be in a fantastic place way down the road.
No doubt. All right, man, let's get back to the beer that we had on the show today. This one was called Cash Flow. It was a collaboration brew by Two Tides Brewing in Savannah and Jay Wakefield Brewing down in Florida. I've been to Two Tides a couple of times now, and man,
but
I love it.
To Jay Wakefield.
Not to Jay Wakefield yet, but I do love Two Tides, man. It's like an awesome spot. I love their beers too. But yeah, what were your thoughts on this beer? It was a sour ale with mango, peach, raspberry, and vanilla.
Yeah, quite fruity, but quite smooth as well. It had a little bit of chew to it, you know, with the vanilla, kind of smoothed it out. It made me think a lot of the giant sweet tarts that I mentioned at the beginning of this episode. Sort of like a sweet tart, sort of smarty, you know, the little smarties.
Oh, yeah.
Candy kind of combined.
My mom liked the sprees, and I got to agree with her. They were pretty good.
Yeah, sprees are good too. But yeah, man, like it was super fruity, but it also had that sort of weedy, chewy finish. Whenever there's a sour like this that kind of has more of a what I call a chewy finish, it often reminds me of cereal, and I like to call it the Captain Crunch finish.
Well, there you go.
Because I swear, it tastes like I'm eating Captain Crunch a little bit there in the end. But yeah, super good, really easy to drink with all the fruit as well. It kind of made me think of like a beer mosa. Made me think I was sitting there at brunch,
yeah,
kind of sipping on something there.
That's probably the perfect description because, yeah, sometimes...
Beer mosa?
Yeah, they'll blend beer, champagne, or whatever. And I think this, yeah, definitely had some beer mosa vibes going on. And like, I just could not pick this beer up when I was at Two Tides because it's called Cash Flow, man. It's got like dollar signs and dollar bills on it. I was like, that's totally our kind of beer.
With I assume the two owners of the two breweries,
that's my guess.
The collaboration on the front of it. So it kind of looks like our album artwork, you know, from our podcast a little bit.
A little bit.
Not quite. It's not exact at all. But yeah, kind of makes me think of it.
Yeah, yeah, but two great breweries, and man, unique flavors with all the fruit and the lactose in there. Smooth and bright, I would say. It did have like some really bright notes because of all the fruit. But yeah, unique and interesting too. I don't know why they call this beer Cash Flow. I would be curious to know like the story behind the name for why a beer that has like all this fruit in it, why they named it that. But we're all about cash flow, and we're all about good beer, so.
That's right. Maybe they knew that by introducing all that fruit, it was actually going to hurt their cash flow because sometimes it costs a lot more to make these kind of beers.
That's true.
But yeah, this one was really good. I'm glad this is one that you picked up that we got to share together. Listeners can find our show notes up on our website at howtomoney.com. For any of the resources that we mentioned during this episode, we'll make sure to include those. That way they're easy to find so that you can learn more about how to manage your money in a more effective way.
Yeah, and I got to say, too, we love listener questions. We also love listener feedback. And
like you mentioned at the beginning of this episode.
Yeah, we love getting the emails. But also, too, Matt, we love constructive criticism.
Sure.
And so if there's anybody out there who's been listening for a while and they're like, man, Matt and Joel need to step their game up in one way or another.
They need to do better.
Yeah. Just go to howtomoney.com/do better. Drop us a line there because that helps us know what we can improve about the show, too. And we appreciate it in advance. Appreciate your time and your thoughtfulness in sending that criticism, that hopefully helpful criticism our way.
Yeah, most definitely.
All right, that's going to do it for today's episode. Matt, so until next time, Best friends out.
Best friends out.